Shortly after the Persian squadrons had returned from patrol back to Phalerum, a tiny boat was slipping out from the dark ranks of the Athenian fleet and making its way across the straits. On board was the trusted tutor of Themistocles' sons, a slave by the name of Sicinus. No sooner had Sicinus set foot on dry land than he was being hurried into the presence of the Persian high command. Certainly, the message that he had to deliver was of the utmost urgency. The Greeks, Sicinus reported, were planning a getaway that very night. "Only block their escape," came the advice, "and you will have a perfect chance of success." Meanwhile, the Athenian admiral himself, revolted by his ally's pusillanimity, was described by his slave as being in full sympathy with the king and earnestly longing for a Persian victory. The imperial espionage chiefs could hardly have hoped to land better news. A dazzling coup indeed. The great king was informed at once. The fleet was ordered to ready itself for battle, and then, rank after rank, pulling out from Phalerum into the waiting darkness, they took to sea. The squadrons glided through the night to the positions allotted them. One, comprising the 200 ships of the Egyptians, had been ordered to circle the entire south coast of Salamis, aiming for the narrow bottleneck of the westernmost strait, there to stopper it in case the Greeks should attempt to escape that way. Others, serrying themselves in ranks of three, cruised into position off the eastern channel, out of which, so their captains had assured them, the panicking Peloponnesians would be bolting at any minute. Just beyond the exit, where it led out to the open sea, there was an island, sacred to Pan, known to the Athenians as Cytilea. Here, setting the seal on the ruthless efficiency of his preparations, the great king stationed a garrison of 400 infantry. Come the midnight breakout, these troops would be directly in the passage of the expected action, ready for all the men and shattered ships that would soon be swept onto the island's rocks. Nothing had been left to chance. Not a single Greek was to be permitted to escape the great king's deadly trap. Meanwhile, Sicinus, the slave whose message had led to all of these preparations, had returned to Themistocles. The Greek admirals, even as the imperial battle squadrons were embarking upon their secret manoeuvres, remained in urgent session, still quarrelling furiously, it is said. At some point towards midnight, Themistocles, who had evidently been having a busy time of it, slipping in and out of the meeting, made his excuses yet again. Stepping outside, he found waiting for him, cloaked in the shadows, an old enemy. Aristeides, the Just, summoned back from exile along with Xanthippus and all the other victims of ostracism, had smoothly resumed his place at the very heart of the democracy's affairs. Returning that same evening from a mission to Aegina, he had seen, as he slipped back towards Salamis, the ominous silhouettes of the Persian fleet fanning out across the gulf to plug the exits from the straits. Themistocles, to whom this news naturally came as little surprise, confessed himself delighted, and told Aristeides that it was all his doing, for our allies had to be forced into making a stand that they would otherwise have shrunk from had it been left to themselves. Then, embracing his old adversary, he urged Aristeides to take the news in to the other admirals, for if I report it, they will think that I'm making it up. All of which, of course, was to cast the Peloponnesians as hapless stooges. Yet it is curious that the Spartans and the other Peloponnesians, once the full details of Themistocles' stratagem had become public knowledge, betrayed not the slightest hint of resentment towards the man who was supposed to have outsmarted them so comprehensively, but, on the contrary, only lauded him for his cleverness and foresight. Nor, despite being ambushed, as we are told by Aristeides' revelation, does it seem that the Greek admirals were thrown into a panic by it. Just the opposite. Their dispositions for the morning appear to reflect the minutest forward planning, almost as though they had been complicit in Themistocles' scheme from the start. Dawn rose on a day as fateful as any in human history, and found every squadron in the Greek fleet primed and nerved for battle. And over the straits, men imagined, there glimmered a sudden sense of something uncanny, an almost palpable heightening of intensity upon the early morning light. To the Athenian marines, before they took their places on deck, Themistocles delivered an address that would long be remembered, urging them to consider all that was best in human nature and affairs, and all that was worst, and to choose the former. Yet not even these words, it may be, raised as many hairs upon the back of men's necks as did the assurance, one that seems suddenly to have swept the entire fleet, that the sons of gods, who in ancient times had been the guardians of the rocks and groves and temples of Greece, were present among them. So that men would later speak of seeing phantoms and even ghostly serpents gliding on the surface of the water, and of hearing unearthly battle cries echoing around the straits.